where the coax is going directly to the wire, and maybe the shield is going nowhere, or maybe the shield is going to some other thing. Because the impedance of that end of the antenna is so high, you can use a 9-to-1 on one of these impedance matching devices. 9-to-1 takes your 50-ohm transmitter up to 450, and now if the antenna happens to be 1,000 ohms, it's only a 2 1/2 to 1 standing wave ratio. If the antenna is resistive, if the antenna happens to be some magic length where the resistive component is 900 ohms and the reactive component is 1,000 ohms, the onion is going to make an improvement, but it's not going to be quite as good as you would like. Let me drop this. So the onion is a good way to go for feeding this kind of antenna. So that's another kind of impedance matching device at the end of the coax cable. And he did say, Rich, that he's got 90 feet of antenna and 100 feet of RG213 feeding it. So I think you're saying there's a magic length around 90 feet, a little bit shorter, a little bit longer, that with a 9-to-1 onion is a known multi-band antenna all in one package. And once you get the VSWR of your coax cable down to 2-to-1, 3-to-1, the loss of the coax cable at HF frequencies is fairly low, whereas his real standing wave ratio might be 20-to-1, if you know what I mean. You start getting numbers that high, and RG213 starts becoming very lossy. And that's what I'm pretty sure Steve is running into. Now, the person who just signed in, something 3NVA, give me your full call letters and name, and then your question on this subject. Over to you, sir. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick. It's Kilo and you're 4 November Zulu Juliet. The name here is Richard. And my question is what about if you use other waves? My friend up the road was telling me that you can also use different waves that are not as common, like a third wave, or a fifth wave, or a sixth wave. Can you also use those instead of a half wave or a quarter wave?
Yeah, there was a couple of dropouts there, Rich. I now know your call letters are Kilo, India 3, November, Victor, Julia is what I think you said. But there were some dropouts, I'm not sure. It turns out that for classic reasons, we like the antenna to be a half wave long, particularly if you're feeding a dipole in the center. It's a very well-known, popular antenna. It's hard to believe. There's nothing magic about the length of the radiator. As long as you can force the radiator into resonance, whether you make it an eighth wave, quarter wave, a 16th of a wavelength long, as long as you can use the right kind of inductors and capacitors and whatever, zigzag, so on, as long as you can force it to be a resonant length, and you can resonate it electronically, it's got a very low loss coax, a very low loss transmission line, like open wire line. Now the resonating network is the tail end of your antenna tuner that's in the shack. It's forcing that whole system, the radiating system, into resonance. Once the radiating system is in resonance, it will radiate well. So there's nothing magic about the length. The classic example that I've used, let me drop. To really bring this home, is that a classic 80-meter dipole is 132 feet of 14-gauge wire fed in the center, hopefully with some kind of a 1-to-1 balancing device. 132 feet of wire on 80 meters is a good half-wave dipole. You go through the mathematics, you'll find out it's got 8,500 square feet of radio area, real effective capture area. Even though the wire itself, the 14-gauge wire, is only casting a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot, 8,500 square feet, a real radio area because it's resonant. You take that 132-foot wire antenna, shrink it down to 25, 30 feet, some crazy number, real small. And then by way of loading coils, these matching networks or whatever, you force it into resonance. You've now got an extremely short piece of wire. You're about to ask, what happened to the gain? What happened to the capture area? An infinitesimal dipole, a dipole is extremely small, but resonated with a low loss impedance matching network, never loses more than half a dB compared to the full size dipole. The gain will be within 4/10 or 5/10 of a dB. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it will be 7,900 square feet because of resonance. You'll get some extremely high voltages at the tip of that tiny dipole when you resonate it. You'll have to work pretty hard to make sure. Let me drop. You'll have to work pretty hard to make sure that that impedance matching network, which is now running at a very high Q, very high circulating current within it, you have to make sure it's made out of low loss materials so it's not wasting some of your power. But the infinitesimal dipole has full gain, full performance. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you shrink the antenna down and you force it into resonance by that means, that total radiating system now has a very high Q. That's a fancy way of saying very narrow bandwidth. If you tuned it for the 3750 portion of the band and you move up to 50 kilohertz, you're going to have to retune things, if you know what I mean. It's going to be very narrow band. But at your favorite frequency, the infinitesimal dipole of any particular... There's no magic length. There is no magic length if you impedance match it and resonate it. Whether it's an eighth wave or 31% longer than an eighth wave, doesn't matter, as long as you force it into resonance. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Rich. I know this is radical sounding equipment, and radical sounding information. Not everybody can accept it at first. Kilo India 3, November Victor Juliet, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, KI4NZJ. Yeah, by the way, Dick, I'm on satellite internet, so that's why I have to drop out. But, yeah, that makes sense, because I've always heard people say, you know, oh, I made a half wave or a quarter wave or, you know, something like that, and I'm thinking, is it possible to make, you know, like a 1/16th wave or something like that, you know?
Now, within the restrictions that I just said, Rich, the answer is yes. A 1/16th wave will work like a charm. It'll have an input impedance where I'm guessing the input impedance is going to be a 2,000 ohms resistive component and 4,000 ohms capacitive reactance component. Every antenna that's shorter than resonant, shorter than half wave, is a capacitive impedance. And if you look at those Brown and Woodward curves I've been telling you about, you'll see that the capacitive impedance goes up real fast, a very steep curve, as the antenna starts getting very short. As you start getting, instead of 90% of a wavelength, which is quarter wave, for a monopole, you start getting it down to 10 degrees of electrical length as a monopole. You're now going to have a capacitive reactance at many thousands of ohms. Don't let that scare you. If that's the only volume you've got in your backyard where you can put up an antenna, or in your roof, in your attic, or whatever, with the right kind of a electronic network, you can force that silly piece of wire into resonance. All of that is going on inside of every one of the cell phones we all own. Let me drop. The industrial designers of cell phones have come to the conclusion that nobody wants to see a whip antenna sticking out of a cell phone anymore. They want the antenna to be all internal. So there's some kind of a zigzaggy, yucky little antenna on the printed circuit board of your cell phone inside of that package, and they're trying to resonate it on five different frequencies at once. Absolutely, positively, cannot be done. But if you study the cell phone schematic diagram, the functional black diagram, you'll find out that connected to that antenna is a very vital integrated circuit that is an impedance matching network. It's an electronically, digital commandable impedance matching network called an antenna tuner. Every one of your cell phones has got an antenna tuner that takes that yucky little so-called antenna in there that's nowhere near the right length, nowhere near the right orientation, certainly doesn't work on all those frequencies, and by that antenna tuner, they force it into resonance at each one of those frequencies when the cell phone is on that particular frequency, and that's what makes the whole thing fly. So electronically, the smart guys in the back rooms of the cell phone manufacturing companies, they've been doing this for quite a few years now, and we amateurs are slowly catching on to us being able to do it. So as you start going through various ways of matching your particular situation, Steve, come back and let us know how it works. And so just because the rich wants to know over there in West Virginia, I'm pretty sure you've got a 90-foot long antenna, 100-foot of RG213 feeding it, and maybe the shield of your coax cable is going nowhere at the antenna end. Give us a repeat on that one, Steve. 82HUC in COMAC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, you have it right. The shield I actually have grounded up at that end, and the center conductor runs out to the long wire. Now, I actually, I thought of Rich's idea with using the UNON. My question regarding the UNON is, and I actually ordered a 4-to-1 because it was the highest ratio that I could get full power from DX Engineering, but and I can modify it once it gets here. It's in a nice weatherproof box and so on and so forth. But my question is, as the frequency that you're feeding the antenna changes, so does the impedance. I ran across a nice cap line, which I'm assuming is the Brown and Woodward curves. You put in the length, you put in the diameter, and the frequency range that you're looking to run, and it spits out all the impedances. And obviously, I mean, as you go from 80 meters to 40 meters, the impedance is going up. So the ratio of the UNON would have to change also based upon the band, or am I misunderstanding that? And let me let it drop. So then as I'm listening to, you know, our conversation progress, my next question is, what about a remote tuner? What if you get the tuner out of the shack and put it up where the coax meets the long wire, so that this way the coax is now part of the sweep circuit, you know, the 50 ohms and very low SWR and, you know, is none the wiser of, you know, what's going on out in the long wire, and keep the very high SWR out in the long wire. Is that an option? KD2HUC, back to net.
Yay, though. That's the Cadillac solution, Steve. If you've got a weatherproof, remotely adjustable antenna tuner at the far end of the transmission line, right at the antenna, that's the Cadillac solution. It's a little bit pricey. Those things are not cheap. Where you said that the center conductor is going directly to your 90-foot piece of wire and the shield is being grounded at that end. The word ground is a mysterious word. If this antenna is at the top of a tower, and now your shield of your coax cable goes to the tower, that's a good local ground. Or if it's on the top of the chimney of the house, I don't know what you would... What did you connect it to that you would call ground? Over to you, Steve. KD2HUC, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Like I said, this was a temporary solution at some nudging. So I do a mast on the chimney that is well grounded. It has a rod sunk, number 6 wire going down. And the way I broke out the coax was I used a mirror mount for a truck. It's basically an SO239 on a bracket that I clamped to the grounded mast, and basically just slip the long wire underneath the center nut, and away we go. It's not pretty, but it works. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, if I understand correctly, you've got a mast that this is all mounted to. There's a beautiful grounding rod somewhere with a piece of wire going somewhere from that grounding rod to either the mast or all the way up the mast. And by the way, if your mast happened to be an insulated structure, I know it's not. And now you brought that grounding rod wire up to the end of your coax cable. You would like to say, well, my coax cable is grounded, the shield is grounded. Well, it's grounded through some number of wavelengths of wire that goes down to that rod in the ground. I'm not saying it's not going to work, just that it's a little bit more complicated structure. But if you're willing to buy an antenna tuner that's remotely tunable, and it's got an up range to it, that's going to do the job perfectly. Let me see what Rich has got to say on this. Rich, you've talked to a lot of guys that have done things like this. How many of them have taken the Cadillac approach of laying down the slightly big bucks to get a remotely tunable, weatherproof antenna tuner at the far end of the cable in order to feed a random length of wire on all of their favorite bands? How many guys have done that? I suspect it's rather few. The few who have done it, are they happy? And did it cost them big bucks? Was the performance what they expected? K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, hope he's still with us. K2RIW, back to you, Rich.
K2UPS Mobile, yep, still here digging in Pennsylvania now. And a point of shopping where he said he couldn't find a 9-to-1 to full power, check out ballondesigns.com. They should have, I'm pretty sure they offer a 9-to-1 that'll take full power out. The going with the automatic tuner at the end of the coaxer to base the antenna or the feed point of the antenna is definitely the way to go, but it is the pricey way. I know a few guys have done it, but most of them don't. They're running the 9-to-1, usually sometimes a 4-to-1, and then using a tuner in the shack, because now your coax is only seeing an SWR less than 3, so the losses aren't that bad, as opposed to running it without the unit and having a much more differential, SWR differential in the line. But it worked out well. I mean, I run a lot of MFET antennas, both at home and portable. I've loaded them up on 162 10 meters, making contacts on all the bands, and for ease of use and ease of putting up, it really can't be beat for a multi-band antenna, in my opinion. Dick, back to that.
Good information, Rich. Awful glad you signed in tonight. You got more of the answers than anybody else. Including me. Christy, I'm not jealous. Part of one of the questions that Steve asked us is that if he's got a 4-to-1 or a 9-to-1 onion, and he does it at frequency A, and then he moves over to a frequency reasonably far away, is the onion going to be right? Part of what's going on here, as I see it, Steve, is that coax cable that's in good shape, you give it a standing wave ratio at the far end of 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, it's reasonably happy. It'll tolerate that. You're starting to get into the really high numbers, 10-to-1, 20-to-1, 30-to-1 standing wave ratio on the coax. All of a sudden, it starts giving you really high insertion loss. And that's part of what I think you're running into. Lots and lots of guys have tried to feed an 80-meter dipole on 40 meters, where the impedance of that dipole is so high that now they're running into 10-to-1, 20-to-1 standing wave ratio type stuff. And they run into a lot of loss of the coax cable unless they flip over to open wire line. So coax cable, it doesn't suddenly go dead at 3-to-1. It'll tolerate 3, 4, 5-to-1. But you jump into the high numbers, and you're starting to get a lot of reflected power. What's really going on with the Viswire is 20-to-1. You could say, with very rough approximation, let me drop. With very rough approximation, you could say that at a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, your reflected power is so high, it comes back to the antenna tuner, which re-reflects it forward, and now that signal is bouncing back and forth 20 times in that cable, because you've got a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. I'm rounding off the numbers tremendously here. I'm just giving you a rough rule of thumb. A 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, that signal is bouncing back and forth 20 times. It's going back and forth, up and down 20 times, which means you're going through the coax cable 40 times. Therefore, you're going to get a hell of a lot more loss. That all adds up. That gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on. I'm going to work out some of the mathematics of that over the next couple of days. Is it exactly 20 times both ways for a 20-to-1 Viswire? We'll work out that one out. But the mathematics existed. But it gives you the flavor of what's going on. Now you know the physics of why it behaves that way. So you're on a good quest here, Steve. And your problem is kind of universal from my point of view. There's a lot of guys who want to do what you're doing. They want to operate a simple antenna on a whole lot of bands. top of the tree with a bow and arrow, with a slingshot, if you know what I mean. And so that could be an extremely good antenna as long as the electronics connected to it is compatible. And that's part of the lesson we're learning here tonight. So as you pursue this, Steve, please come back and let us know how you're making progress. And maybe you need some fills in some of what you've heard so far. KD2HUC with some more info. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Steve.
Yeah, no, I think I got it. Yeah, no, it's, like I said, this is more of a short-term solution, so I'm certainly not going to lay out the bucks for a remote tuner. That was more for just my own knowledge, you know, more of, you know, how you would mitigate this. I did, like I said, I did order a relatively inexpensive Unun. That I'm going to open up and I'm going to modify to try and, you know, if I can get up. According to the numbers that I crunched on the internet, it looks like I could be anywhere between 1,500 and 2,500 ohms impedance on the antennas, so I may need to go as high as 30 to 1 on the Unun. But, you know, I'll go back and forth and keep trying. This is now more of a quest just to, you know, see if I can solve the problem. Hopefully I'll have the DXCC up midsummer, and this problem will go away. But with that, thanks, Dick, and I'll let you know how I make out. KD2HUC, back to net.
Very fine, Steve. I just did a quick measurement here, and sure enough, if your antenna is a 2,500 ohm impedance, which is very realizable, an end-fed wire getting close to resonant or being very part resonant where it's highly reactive can easily be 2,500 ohms of total impedance. 2,500 ohms on a 50 ohm coax is a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio. If I did the mathematics right, let me double check that. 2,500, yep. And 50 ohm coax cable is a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio. That's huge. That poor coax cable starts hurting at around 10 to 1, and you might be as high as 50 to 1. And top of that, how high is the impedance of the antenna? If the antenna impedance is 2,500 ohms as a pure resistor, that's one kind of antenna. If it's 2,500 ohms and most of the impedance is capacitive reactant, that's worse. Because let me give you an example on that one. Let me drop it. One of the puzzles that I've given to quite a few of my electronic engineers, guys with a lot of radio experience, a lot of years, and you tell them, I've got a variable capacitor in a shielded box, and at my favorite frequency, which is maybe 100 megahertz, I'm going to carefully adjust that capacitor so it's exactly a 50 ohm capacitor reactant. It's in a shielded box, and I'm going to feed it with a piece of 50 ohm cable going into that shielded box. So I've got a perfect 50 ohm capacitive load on the end of a 50 ohm cable. What's the standing wave ratio of that system? And about 85% of the engineers will say it's 1 to 1. You've got a 50 ohm load on a 50 ohm cable. I then ask them, okay, if it was a 50 ohm resistor and I'm pouring a watt into that cable, a watt would be dissipated into that 50 ohm dummy load. But this dummy load is a 50 ohm capacitor. It's not dissipating any power. I'm putting a lot of power into that cable. Where's it going? And then you see a funny look on their face. And they suddenly realize the fact that it's 50 ohms doesn't solve the problem. If it's a capacitor, a really good high quality capacitor, it absorbs no power. It reflects 100% of the power it sees. What's the standing wave ratio in that case? Infinity. So what I'm getting at is a reactive load, as far as VISWAR is concerned, is a hell of a lot more detrimental to a system than a resistive load, even though the impedance is the exact same number. So now you see why. You have to resonate first. Resonate means you've gotten rid of the reactive component. If your antenna is too short and it's a capacitor, and you force it into resonance, you've canceled that capacitor. That's what you've done when you resonate it. Now it can radiate. Now you get a little bit more of a clue as to what's going on. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in with a question. Got a good set of questions tonight.
Repeater, timeout.
went an hour and 37 minutes before timing out the machine. How about that? A new record here, Steve, John. Now we're going to go over to that other very important part of the TechNet, that mailbag. And some of these guys, boy, they've got questions that really dig into our understanding of physics. Let's see what John's got tonight. KC2WGB, the mailbag maven. Come here, John. K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, good evening to everyone on the net. Thanks for dropping by. Yeah, I have a nice question here. You had mentioned a couple of weeks ago, well, quite a few times you had mentioned the fact that, let me let it drop. You had mentioned the use of a type of control of transmission frequency by our satellites and some of our spacecraft, that the ground control signal transmitted is what determines the frequency that it will transmit back to us. That's how they control it. Well, this young man would like to know, when was that developed? About how many years has that been in the process? Was it also used in tube state systems, or is it only with microprocessors they were able to do that? Maybe give a little history on that subject. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Okay, I first became aware of this on the Apollo 15 satellite, 1969-1970 time frame, in which I'm communicating with NASA saying, what are the frequencies, uplink and downlink? I want to listen to them directly, the S-band downlink. And I found out about the so-called deep space network, which a lot of it operates on 2 gigs, 8 gigs, the bathtub-shaped curve is atmospheric insertion loss versus frequency. So for these space capsules, they use that frequency region a lot, 2 gigs to 10 gigs region at the bottom of the bathtub of insertion loss of the atmosphere. And I found out about the frequency ratio being used on Apollo, all of the Apollo spacecraft. The main uplink frequency was usually low and the downlink frequency was high. The ratio is 240 over 221. So the uplink frequency became the frequency reference. The receiver would listen to that signal, and by electronic means, it would multiply the ratio 240 over 221, input frequency to output frequency. Therefore, you knew the exact output frequency you're going to get because you've determined it with the input. They handed me this great big green book describing the deep space network. The great big green book, which is the design of the system of all of those dishes, is going to talk to all of those Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo spacecraft. That was designed around 1982, or at least the book was published in 1982. So around 1982, to my knowledge, they knew that this would be a very crafty way of doing things. Let me drop it. And so now you know the exact frequency of what's coming back down. That gives you the ability to do some extremely precise ranging. You literally can count every cycle you sent up because you know exactly how many cycles you're going to get down of that radio frequency. On 2 gigs, where each cycle is a wavelength of 4.5 inches, you can range, you can determine range to the nearest 4.5 inches out of many thousands of miles. It's a beautiful system. So that's when I first became acquainted with it, the so-called Great Big Green Book describing the deep space network. And so all of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo used it. Many of the spacecraft are using it. You go to that website that was given to us by Paul, WS2N, a space expert. There's a website of NASA where at this instant of time, you go to that website, it'll tell you of all the dishes in the world that they've got in Australia, Spain, and Redstone in California. All of those dishes, they got a 70-meter dish, a 35-meter dish, a 10-meter dish. So they got a whole bunch of dishes, all being used for uplinks and downlinks to all of these various satellites. Let me drop it. You go to that website. It'll tell you exactly what frequency they're transmitting for the uplink, exactly what frequency they're getting for the downlink, exactly what signal strength they're getting in the downlink, exactly what azimuth and elevation the dish is aimed to, exactly how much wind is blowing during that last couple of seconds. All of that data is there live, real time. By the way, you go and look at the Voyager spacecraft, sometimes you get confused. You say, hey, Voyager right now, they're listening to Voyager, they're listening to the downlink, and they're not transmitting an uplink. How come? Well, they transmitted the uplink to Voyager yesterday. The round trip time is 37 hours. So 37 hours ago, they could have stopped transmitting the uplink, and you're going to be getting the downlink from Voyager for the next 37 hours. That's how long that pipeline is out there, 12 billion miles to Voyager. So you can see those exact frequencies, up, down, exact powers, antenna aiming, how many watts they're transmitting, and so on. Beautiful system. So if you like doing calculations, once you know how to calculate free space loss, and free space loss is very calculatable. How many dB is there in free space between antenna, antenna, and antenna B? It's a very simple formula. Let me drop. Insertion loss is 36.6 dB added to 20 times log F plus 20 times log D. F is frequency in megahertz. D is distance in miles. That's it. 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. Frequency in megahertz, distance in miles. You plug in those numbers, frequency, distance, and that equation, you know exactly how many dB is the free space loss. If you're a transmitting antenna with an isotropic antenna, 0 dB of gain over ISO, and your receiving antenna is 0 dB of gain over ISO, that's the exact number you're going to get, the power difference between the transmit power and the receive power. Now, in the case of the Goldstone dish, 70 meters, 230 feet diameter, it's got a gain of something like 70 dB on transmit and receive. The dish on the Voyager spacecraft, which is 8 feet in diameter, I forget what the gain was, something like 43 dB. So you subtract the 43 and the 70, the gains of the dishes on each end, but leave the free space loss, and now you know exactly how much power you're going to get out of the receiver, so to speak, when that transmitter is putting that much power into the transmitting antenna. It's a very exact science. Let me drop.
Do you want that website again, Dick? WS2N.
As soon as you start, in a few minutes, you're going to be giving that website. So don't worry, Steve. I mean, Paul. So you would think that after 12 billion miles, and that satellite was launched in 1937, that's what, 35 years ago, you would think that radio signal going 12 billion miles through space would get tired, and there'd be some other source of loss. Uh-oh, there ain't any. That space in between us and that Voyager is the hardest vacuum in the world. There's nothing there to absorb. You get a little bit of absorption of the atmosphere, another fraction of a dB at these frequencies, as long as you're not getting a torrential rain over that dish that's doing the receiving or the transmitting. So when I plugged in those numbers with Voyager during one of those missions a week or two ago, when I was doing a listening of Voyager, I calculated how many watts going into the dish at Voyager, three times the distance of Pluto away, how many watts would have to go into that dish in order to give that signal strength at the Goldstone receiving site in Spain at the time, or was it Australia, I'm not sure which, of minus 153 dBm. And the answer was something like 10 watts. 10 and a fraction watts had to be going into that transmitting antenna at Voyager. And the transmitting antenna has got something like a couple of tenths of a dB of a degree of beam width. That dish, that satellite is going to be aimed very precisely. It's a pencil beam that's going to be aimed exactly at Earth, or else we're not going to hear it. And the Goldstone dish has something like a 30th of a degree of beam width. Wow. So now, if the wind blows real hard on the 70-meter dish and moves it a little bit by bending the steel, you might steer the beam and lose the satellite signal, if you know what I mean. So on a super windy day, can they listen to Voyager? The answer might be no. So this is some of the information I think that guy was asking you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIWN.
Repeater, timeout.
I did it again. Twice in the same few minutes. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, only when you're talking to me. All right. Very good. Interesting subject. And used well. Yeah. That's impressive. Those numbers are impressive. You talk about that kind of distance and
they can actually tell position and many other things with the information they gather. I guess it's worth spending that money on the space program just for that. All right, I'm going to drop with the one for the next question. Okay, I have a gentleman with two Yagi antennas for 2 meters. He has one pole, which he has a little antenna on top of that, which is a 900 megahertz, sort of like a whip. But he wants to put these 2 meter Yagis on the pole, and he wants to have them coordinated in a way that they're going to be in phase. He has no other way to mount them. They have to be stacked on top of each other. He'd like to know what the distance between that spacing for optimum performance to be able to get maximum gain and not have interference and have enough of the aperture available for each antenna. So maybe you can give him a quick rundown on that, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I sure can, John. But the biggest variable is how big is a 2 meter Yagi? Is it a 3-element or a 13-element?
Element.
Give me that again.
5-element.
Okay, 5-element Yagi on 2 meters. I'm going to guess it's got around 9 dB of gain. 9 dB of gain probably means, I can work out the mathematics of this during your next question, and I'll come back with it. I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 8 or 10 feet of diameter of effective capture area. Therefore, if the two antennas were stacked 8 or 10 feet apart, the circle of effective capture area of each Yagi on 2 meters would not be overlapping at all. And in theory, you get full performance. All the experiments people have run is that when you've got two circles of effective capture area and you've got them just kissing each other, just touching, and now you start moving the two antennas closer together, so the two circles start overlapping. The magic of a circle is that the overlapping area at first is kind of small. It isn't until you start getting a quarter of the diameter away from each other that it starts really stacking up fast. So everybody stacks it a little bit closer than that. And you're going to sacrifice a couple of tenths of a dB. In theory, when you stack a pair of Yagis, you're going to get the exact same gain of each Yagi, but now because there's a pair of them, the total antenna system, let me drop it. The total antenna system could have 3.01 dB of more gain. That's what a 2-to-1 ratio is. In the real world, when you do it all, you get numbers like 2.7 dB of gain, but you get a lot of extra gain. When you do that, you've now got these two chunks of area vertically stacked, which means that the vertical beamwidth has now become a vertical interferometer. That means your vertical beamwidth just went down to probably one quarter of it was for one single Yagi, and that's also very calculatable. On top of that, you're now going to develop a couple of interferometry side lobes, maybe 20 degrees to the top, 20 degrees below the horizon. There's going to be a significant side lobe from this pair of Yagis. Don't lose sleep over that. That's the normal physics that's got to be there. But you vertically stacked them. Your vertical beamwidth went down by a whole lot. Your horizontal beamwidth didn't change at all. So vertical stacking is the nicest way to stack because you've now got a nice horizontal beamwidth, and that's the way you operate your antenna rotator, so it's easy to use the antenna rotator. Aiming the thing is equal to the aiming difficulty you had with one single Yagi, just that all signals are now almost 3 dB louder. Let me drop. But if you had a vertical elevation control, you'd realize that the vertical beamwidth has now gotten a lot more narrow. You could, if you want to, horizontally stack them. And there's an advantage in doing that. Although it becomes very narrow in azimuth with horizontal stacking, it now takes up a lot less mast space. You can stack a lot more antennas on that mast. On top of that, you might easily have a situation where there are two strong local repeaters, we'll say, and in between those two repeaters is the weak repeater that's 30 miles away you want to listen to because that's where your brother lives. And now with horizontal stacking, you've got this very sharp horizontal beamwidth with some deep nulls in it. And you could, on a good day, you could choose just the right spacing between the two Yagis so that you're able to steer the first node. Let me explain that one. Every antenna's got a main lobe. In the case of an interferometer, there's always a deep side lobe and a side lobe, off to one side, to the left and to the right. And if you set the spacing between the Yagis just right, you can aim the two nodes at those two nearby strong repeaters that give you grief. And now the main lobe, and so you're not going to hear them, they're both in the node, and the main lobe is going right down the middle of the two, hearing this far away repeater that's close to your brother's house. So you'd be amazed how much science there is of setting up spacing and stacking. And does the stacking have to be purely horizontal? That horizontal bar that mounts the two antennas could be set up at a 45 degree angle. Let me drop it. So that now you're halfway between horizontal stacking and vertical stacking. And in certain situations where that predictable total antenna pattern would be to your advantage. So you'd be amazed how many extra knobs you've got in your hand when you start stacking the antennas. On top of that, the area of a Yagi, its effective capture area, exists at and only if at its approximate resonant frequency. If that Yagi is tuned to 146 megs, and you stack it in between nearby 6-meter antennas and 220 antennas, the 2-meter antenna will not see the other antennas. The other antennas will not see the two. The effective capture area of your Yagi exists where each of those directors have just the right tuning off of frequency a little bit. The directors are tuned a little bit high, the reflectors are tuned a little bit low, but each of those parasitic elements have to be the right resonant frequency at the right position in space, the right number of wavelengths away from that driven element. Let me drop. You feed that 2-meter Yagi on 432, and your first impression is, hey, that's a new resonant frequency, it's the third harmonic. Yeah. You do that, you run, you measure the gain of the 2-meter Yagi at 2 meters, and it's got the 90 dB gain it's supposed to have. You feed it at 432, and you find out it's got the same gain as a dipole. The driven element at 432 is doing a beautiful job of radiating. All those parasitic elements are not on the right resonant frequency, and they're not in the right position in three-dimensional space. They're not giving you the Yagi phenomena. They're not giving you that refractive optics. They're not giving you the magnifying glass effect. They're not giving you the gain. That 2-meter Yagi on 432 has got about the same gain. It's going to have a little bit higher. This one's got the same gain as a dipole. It's not a five-element Yagi anymore. As such, you can stack 2-meter Yagis and 432 Yagis super close to each other, because on the opposite frequency, the effective capture area is not there. There's lots and lots of people who stack various bands of various Yagis on the same mast, and they add up all the effective capture areas and stack them far enough apart that none of them overlap. It works, but it's much too severe. And now you've got a great big tall mast that when the wind comes along, it's going to buckle it for you. You didn't have to make the mast that tall. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I wonder if you think this comes close to what he was asking, John. Over to you.
KC2WGB, absolutely. That's exactly what he's interested in. One other thing he'd like to know is, what length of cable to keep them in phase does he need from the first antenna to the second before he picks up the downlink?
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me on that one. The usual way it's done is that the cable coming from the upper Yagi and the cable coming from the lower Yagi, you make those two cables the exact same length. You bring them together and at a power divider midway between the two antennas, and your main feed line comes up to that point. That's the usual way it's done. And that power divider, in the ideal world, is a real 2-to-1 power divider, with impedance matching and isolation in the works. You'll get 95% of the performance if you make that so-called power divider nothing more than a T-connector. Bring the two cables together at the T-connector, and yes, you're going to have a pair of 50-ohm cables coming together, giving you 25 ohms in the middle of the T-connector. Therefore, your 50-ohm cable, your main transmission line feeding it, is going to see a 2-to-1 VISWA. Well, 2-to-1 VISWA, in the worst case, gives you half a dB of insertion loss. So as a quickie test, it's a good way to go. Now, if you go the next step, if you now make the cable between EGI and that T connector an odd number of quarter wavelengths of 70 ohm cable, you're now doing a number kind of impedance matching. An odd number of 70 ohm pieces of cable will convert 50 ohms into 100 ohms. It's a 2-to-1 balancing device. A coax balance, I think they call it. No, it's not a coax balance. They got a name for it, and I can't think of it right now. But so each 50 ohm antenna at the far end of a 70 ohm piece of cable that's an odd number of quarter wavelengths long electronically, including the velocity factor of the cable, now makes a pair of 100 ohms coming together at the T connector. Therefore, the whole thing will be a perfect impedance match. Lots of guys do that. And the 70 ohm cable could be the hard line that's used for cable TV.
The repeater, timeout.
The hardline 70 ohm cable that's being used for cable TV. There's zillions of feet of that laying around Long Island, if you know what I mean. And so that would be a way of doing it. What some people try to do is to bring the transmission line up to the lower Yagi, and then with a T connector, bring another piece of cable up to the upper Yagi. And that will give you a slightly uneven power distribution. The lower Yagi will be getting a little more power. That's not the ideal way of doing it. You could do it that way, but I don't recommend it. There's one other thing you've got to be careful of, and that is you're now going to be bringing a pair of coax cables to a point midway between the two antennas where you're going to bring your transmission line up to that point, and some kind of a power divider goes there. Because people are now doing a real careful job and they want everything to be symmetrical, they'll make the upper Yagi right side up, or they'll make the lower Yagi right side up and the upper Yagi upside down in order to bring the cables more conveniently to that point midway between the two. Do not do that. If you do that, you've created 180 degrees of phase shift of one of the Yagis by flipping it upside down. You do that, and now you'll create a perfect null on the horizon. You'll have a beautiful main lobe 30 degrees above the horizon and 30 degrees below the horizon. A zillion guys have fallen into that trap. Let me drop. So you want to arrange it in such a way that if the voltage coming out of your transmission right now is a positive voltage, so to speak, on this half cycle, you want to make sure that the signal getting to the lower Yagi gives you a positive voltage on the right-hand side of its driven element at the exact same instant of time that the upper Yagi has a positive voltage on the right-hand side of its driven element. Those two driven elements on those two Yagis better be operating exactly in phase with each other. And now you get a beautiful peak on the horizon. You do it upside down, 180 degrees of phase shift, you'll get a null on the horizon. You could, if you want to, now go the next step in physics. Let me drop. You could make the lower Yagi right side up, the upper Yagi upside down, 180 degrees of phase shift, but now you shift the position of the upper Yagi half wavelength further forward or half wavelength further back. You shift those two Yagis, one, you push one further forward, closer to the target, or further away. You move it by a half wavelength, you've now forced them electronically and physically to be back in phase on the horizon. At first it sounds crazy. You'd be amazed how many people have done that with horizontal stacking, because they want to get rid of co-channel interference. They're listening to the channel 2 signal coming from Philadelphia, and they want to null out the channel 2 signal coming from New York City. And by using a pair of antennas horizontally stacked, and they physically move one ahead of the other, and they've adjusted the coax cable length accordingly, they can now electronically steer a null toward New York City, the strong local channel 2. At the same time, the main lobe is aimed at the weaker signal coming from Philadelphia on channel 2, in my example. It's called a co-channel interference steering device. And so you're using phased array techniques on a very simple pair of Yagis by adjusting cable lengths and their positions. You've got a lot of knobs in your hand when you're putting up these antennas together. You'd be amazed how many variables you can play with. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the check net.
Very good, Dick. So basically, he uses the T connector in between the two antennas. If he couples that from the T to both antennas with 70 ohm line, then use 50 ohm line going down, he'll have a better match. Is that correct?
He'll have a perfect match if and only if the 70 ohm chunks of line are exactly an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. If these pieces of 70 ohm cable were an even number of wavelengths long, like a half wave, 50 ohms in is a 50 ohms out. Coax cable repeats and impedance if it's an even number of quarter wavelengths. It does impedance inverting if there's an odd number of quarter wavelengths of cable. It's craziness. So, with what you've described, it wouldn't be a better match, it would be a perfect match. But as a quickie, he could use 50 ohm cables of equal length coming from the antennas to that T connector, and then feed his 50 ohm transmission line to it. There'll be a 2-to-1 VISWR at that point. That'll give him half a dB of loss. Because he's using a pair of Yagis where he gets almost 3 dB of gain, and he gets a half a dB of loss because of the VISWR, he's still got 2.5 dB of extra gain by using two antennas. As a quickie experiment, before he gets a hold of the 70 ohm cable that he puts in later on, he can do that. It's not a showstopper. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's the best way to go, I believe. That stuff is everywhere, that 70 ohm cable. He can pick that up and do a nice job. Okay? So an odd number of quarter wavelengths will do it for him. I hope you're paying attention out there. Making notes. Very good. Oh, that's it, Dick. I only had two questions in the mailbag, so we'll shoot over to Paul and see what's new. KC2WGB.
Because those two pieces of 70 ohm cable might in some cases only be a quarter wavelength or 3/4 of a wavelength long, there's so little of it, you could even use 70 ohm cable intended for cable television wiring inside of a house. You know, RG59 or RG6 is the more sophisticated version of RG59, 70 ohm flexible cable. I worry a little bit about the fact, though, that some of those cables you get a hold of are foam-filled. And worry about the fact that after a couple of years, a foam-filled cable, flexible cable, the water vapor slowly migrates through that outer jacket into the foam, and the insertion loss goes up. But because he's using so little of it, it doesn't have to be super hardline, half, three-quarter, and 7/8 inch in diameter. Just the ordinary 70 ohm cable with F connectors on the end would do it. The T connector could be an F connector, T connector. You'd have to do some kind of adapting, though, at the end that goes to the individual Yagi. So there's lots of cables that'll work. Okay, let's see what Paul's got to say tonight. And Paul, start off with that website that gives you that beautiful NASA place that'll tell you. They'll tell you exactly which of their deep space dishes are being used, what spacecraft they're listening to right now, and all the data on that spacecraft and the signal strength and whatever. WS2N, and this is going to be Space Report number 200. His odometer just flipped over. Space Report number 200. Go ahead, Paul. K2RIW in a second.
This is WS2N. Yeah, I wanted to give that out before, in case somebody was listening to what you were saying and that they were interested in that website. And that's https://eyes, EYES.nasa.gov/DSN, that stands for Deep Space Network, and again, /DSN.html. So it's https://eyes.nasa.gov/DSN/DSN.html. And when you were talking about it, of course, I brought it up. And Madrid was on, and they were talking to NHPC, and that's New Horizon, you know, Pluto mission. That passed Pluto last summer, July. And they were transmitting away. And Madrid was transmitting when I was watching it. They were transmitting up at 7.18 gigahertz. And they were transmitting over 16 kilowatts of power. But on a received end, I went around for the received end, and they're down to minus 147 dB. So we, you know, what they're picking up is incredible. So there you go. That's a story on the Deep Space Network. Let me continue. There's a couple of stories I wanted to talk about that's going on with NASA and with the world space community. But the breaking news I would have this week would be Wednesday with SpaceX again. They sent up a Japanese satellite to geosynchronous orbit, launched from Cape Canaveral, from their launch complex 40 that SpaceX has taken over in recent years. And it was successfully launched. It was called JC-SAT-14 was the name of the satellite. But it was another chance for SpaceX to bring a booster back to the barge and drop it. They were successful in doing it. It was a nighttime launch. I watched it. It was 1:21 at night when it went off. And roughly 8 minutes later, this thing came flying out of the sky and landed on the ASDS, the Autonomous Spaceport drone ship that he owns. Two of these things. One is out in the Pacific to be utilized for the Vandenberg, California flights, and he's got the other one. This one is called "Of Course I Still Love You." He named it, and second time it was successful on a barge. Just recently, when they had a launch for NASA, and they sent up the beam module, the inflatable module, and attached it to the International Space Station. That flight, they were successful in bringing the first stage back also, and then now that's in his warehouse in Florida with the original one that they had brought back to Cape Kennedy. It landed on land. That was the first one back in last December. So now he successfully has landed three of these things, and this one was right on the money. I mean, he had live TV coverage from the barge itself, and you could just see the lights on the barge, and then this thing came out of the sky in one big flash of light. It went dark for a second, and then the next scene you saw was the first stage sitting dead center of the barge. This time he was dead center. Last time he was off a couple of meters, but he was right in the middle. You could see the residual flames coming out of the rocket, and this 155-foot towering first stage sitting there. And right now, as we speak, it's presently on the way back to Cape Canaveral. So that was very successful, and he didn't give it much of a chance of landing like last time. Last time he had quite a bit of fuel left. When he goes up to the space station, he's only sending up cargo to 250 miles up, geosynchronous, all the way to 23,000 miles. And because of that, he's traveling at really twice the speed when the booster disconnects.